the fallout from the Chilcot report continues. Yesterday's damning indictment said that the UK went to war in Iraq before all peaceful options for disarming Saddam Hussein were exhausted. Sir John Chilcot added that the invasion was based on flawed intelligence and assessments that were not challenged.
We have concluded that the UK chose to join the invasion of Iraq before the peaceful options for disarmament had been exhausted. Military action at that time was not a last resort. The judgments about the severity of the threat posed by Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, WMD, were presented with a certainty that was not justified. Despite explicit warnings, the consequences of the invasion were underestimated. The planning and preparations for Iraq after Saddam Hussein were wholly inadequate. The government failed to achieve its stated objectives.
Let's speak to the DUP MP, Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, whose brother Kingsley served in Iraq. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. It's damning this, isn't it, of Tony Blair's decision to take the country into war, and there's no more serious decision a government can take than to send its country to war, Geoffrey.
That is true, Stephen, and I was a member of Parliament at the time this decision was taken. Backbench MP has very limited access to information, so you rely heavily on what the Prime Minister and his ministers tell you. And they were very clear at the time that the intelligence information they claim to have provided sufficient evidence, in their view, to justify the UK joining America in the invasion of Iraq. And, of course, the focus was at that time on weapons of mass destruction, although the government over time did shift their justification for the war more towards removing Saddam Hussein, claiming that he had been responsible for the indiscriminate killing of a million Iraqi citizens prior to the war. But, of course, that was not the main reason given at the time by the Prime Minister when he presented his case to the House of Commons. And I think this report clearly concludes that not all the peaceful options had been exhausted before this decision was made. We were told they had been, and that the intelligence was deeply flawed.
So knowing what you know now, do you regret voting for the war?
Of course, and it was not an easy decision, Stephen, as you pointed out. We were voting to send our men and women of the armed forces into harm's way, into a war situation. And I think that the armed forces acted with great valour. I think particularly of the Royal Irish Regiment, who achieved pretty much all of their objectives that were set for them. I think they can be proud of what they did, in the sense that our armed forces did what the government required of them. But I think this report does raise serious questions about the resources that were given to our armed forces. I heard also former Assistant Chief Constable Stephen White on Radio Ulster this morning, a man I have a great respect for, who was heading up the policing mission in Basra, and made clear that he too, when he saw additional resources, was more or less slapped down at the time. So I think that the issues are about more, and the lessons that need to be drawn from this report are about more than just how the decision to go to war was taken. It's also about how government and what government does to support our armed forces when we place them in a situation of conflict like this. And I have to say, Stephen, when I voted for the UK to be involved in this conflict in Iraq, I did so knowing that my brother was sitting on the Kuwait-Iraq border with his unit about to deploy on the front line, the first troops into Iraq, and he was among them. He did 5 tours of duty in Iraq, and I think we need now to listen to not only what Sir John Chilcot has said, but also I think we need to listen to some of the senior military people who've been talking it for a long time. And when I was on the Defence Committee in the House of Commons, we heard from them. Now, the lessons that we can draw from this experience in Iraq.
The number this morning, 030-30-80-55-55. Peter has a question for you, Geoffrey. Morning, Peter.
Morning, Stephen.
Go ahead.
It seems to me that we are Britain followed America in the war, just plainly, and America went into Iraq after the Twin Towers 9/11 incident. I was wondering if Geoffrey could tell me what the connection is between 9/11 and Iraq, because I don't know what the connection is.
It's a fair question, Peter. I think there was some evidence that Al-Qaeda were operating in Iraq, but I don't think there is any substantive evidence to support a view that what was happening in Iraq at the time somehow contributed to the 9/11 situation prior to it. But there's no doubt that the Al-Qaeda have used the Iraq situation as justification for some of the things that they have done in hitting back, particularly at America, but also at the UK. And we do need to understand that when we go to war, there are consequences of those decisions, and sometimes the consequences are that innocent people lose their lives, both in a theatre of war and even in our own country.
Well, Colonel Tim Collins is listening to this from the Royal Irish Regiment. Morning to you, Tim.
Good morning.
Good morning. You've told the Belfast Telegraph that Tony Blair was drunk on his own self-importance when he ordered the invasion of Iraq. Is that not deeply unfair on a man who had to make a decision? It might have been the wrong decision. That's for others to decide, not for me. But drunk on his own self-importance? You stand over that?
He launched a war that we weren't ready for, and he was told we weren't ready for. And this was the master of spin, who was puffed up with successes in Sierra Leone and Kosovo. And the simple fact of the matter was that... And talking last night to the Chief of General Staff at the time, Mike Jackson, he reiterated that they were told clearly we weren't ready to go at that time.
But nevertheless, we shouldn't forget what Saddam Hussein had done in the past. He had released chemical weapons on his own people. He was capable of mass murder. There's no doubt he was seen as a terrorist by many respectable governments. And Blair had a decision to make. You know, Tim, when you look
What you have to ramp back there and then just visit the planet Earth, the fact of the matter was he lied. He knew that they were exaggerating the evidence, and the troops were deployed in our firm belief, because that's what we were told, and we believe what our leaders tell us, was that they had a ready, capable nuclear arsenal ready to go in 45 minutes. And it's clear now they knew that was not the case.
Well, that's not what
the
report said.
To go at the time.
That is not what the Chilcot report said, of course. The Chilcot report did not say that Tony Blair, or indeed any of his advisors at the time, exaggerated the information.
They misrepresented the information. The dossier that was presented said that there was missiles ready to go in 45 minutes, and that's clearly not the case. And that was assertion, the 45 minutes assertion, came from the British. That was made up by them. So much so, actually, Saddam Hussein had a meeting of the Revolutionary Council, and he wanted to know from his 12 members, do we have a capability in 45 minutes? And they all said, no, we don't. We don't know where that came from.
You know, some of the coverage yesterday, Tim, and Geoffrey Donaldson, Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, if you think of some of the clips that were being pushed out on the BBC News last night, and indeed other news networks, for example, Tony Blair is one of the worst terrorists in the world.
Well, I know you're a shock jock, but you just got to calm down sometimes. That came from someone who'd lost someone. Of course, he's not the worst terrorist in the world. You can think of 100 more, but you can't take what someone highly emotional who's lost someone dead in conflict and start bashing them over the head. Well, you can, but I don't think that's the right thing to do.
Do you know what, Tim? I'll just say this to you, and I've done a few interviews with you, but when I'm talking about war, I understand as well as you do, and I've interviewed a lot of people who have lost their lives. So do not, sir, suggest that I'm doing this in order to be a shock jock. I find it deeply offensive that you've said that. You are wrong and you should not have said it. Now I'll move on. I'm trying to put questions to you that I think are journalistically appropriate. Full stop. And don't bring this down to some type of base level because I find it offensive. Now, Jeffrey Donaldson, when you put yourself in the type of circumstance that Blair is in, he's being scrutinised by around the world. And all I'm trying to say this morning is, what a difficult decision it must be to be the leader of a country, Sir Jeffrey, and to have to make a decision. Do you think there's any fairness in the question that I'm asking?
I think there is, Stephen. And I've no doubt that Tony Blair was probably pressured to a degree by President Bush. But in the end, you know, a prime minister has to come to a judgment and make a judgment in our national interest. And I think we've learned a lesson from that. And I think particularly of the recent decision that we made not to go to war in Syria and the first vote in Parliament when the current prime minister recommended that we go to war. And Parliament said, well, we haven't been convinced by the arguments. We don't see what the end outcome of this is. We don't see that you've got a proper plan. And actually, the decision of the UK Parliament on that occasion caused the American government then to pull back from its decision. I would also say, Stephen, in defence of Tony Blair, we should not lose sight in Northern Ireland that Tony Blair was instrumental in the peace process. That he, and I saw this firsthand in 1997, 98 and onwards, he was very much up in the lead on the UK government side in terms of taking the peace process forward and spoke passionately about his opposition to terrorism and ending terrorism in Northern Ireland. But I did learn this about him. He had a very clever use of words. He had a great command of the English language, but he had a capacity sometimes, and it became known as spin in the Tony Blair era. He had a capacity to take words, and we called it constructive ambiguity. He would say things that would mean the same to one side and something completely different to the other side.
Well, and that's
I think that's part of the problem here. And I think, you know, and I think Tim is right. You know, when he talks about the families, they must be very, very angry about all
of course. And Colonel Collins, what you did, of course, which I didn't do and very few others did, other than people like you and the brave armed forces, you put your life on the line. And people like you who were sent to war, how does it now feel when you hear Chilcot say that that war was not necessary, that there were other steps that could have been taken before it? How does that feel, Tim?
Well, there comes a point when I think the Chilcot report is the beginning of something and by no means the end of things. I think that certainly the experience that we had, ludicrous things like having to paint our vehicles with the green paint we had and drive them through the desert in order to make them camouflaged in the desert, that we dealt with that. But I think the bigger questions that have to be asked for the families is when there was a clear threat post the when the Iraqi army was defeated and then disbanded, and it was clear we were facing an insurgency, the decision to keep wearing soft hats and patrol a la Northern Ireland and snatch vehicles, etc., when people knew the threat to life was very real, was the decision not to change the stance and provide heavy equipment there because of spin in order to keep things looking good and whistle up a wind? Or was it done through incompetence? And that needs to be examined because lives were lost as a result of that.
And tell me about
lives were lost because of spin.
Tell me having to
be held to account.
Tell me about having to paint the vehicles, because that sounds outrageous. It sounds as if we, as Chilcot had said, that you were not prepared sufficiently. We didn't give you the resources that you needed, so you were having to literally paint vehicles while being out there.
We our vehicles arrived by sea, and when they arrived, they were green. We sent out for paint to camouflage them and obviously paint them in desert colors, and it just wasn't the paint. The paint wasn't available.
That's incredible.
What we did have, what the quartermaster had, was the paint that we'd brought with us, which is olive green. And then someone came up with the bright idea, which was actually very good, was to paint the vehicles freshly, then drive them fast through the desert, and then the dust stuck to the vehicle.
Is that not demoralizing?
Very effective. Well, in the first Gulf War, when I was serving with the SAS, our camouflage consisted then of pouring sand-coloured paint over our helmets. This is the norm in the British Army, I'm afraid. You're always a day late and a dollar short.
Did you just say that the dust stuck to the paint and that's what was providing the camouflage?
It was, and then as we'd finished that, then miraculously the paint appeared, and so we ended up painting them twice.
You see, I would have thought, my goodness, I'm learning something this morning, Tim, and I know the Chilcot report alluded to this, but when we're hearing from someone like you that's been there, I would have thought that a country as rich as the United Kingdom, that our soldiers would have been going out there with the very best of equipment. And that's clearly not the case, right?
The kit just wasn't on the shelves, and that's the excuse. But, you know, that's understandable in a certain way. What's not understandable was the Royal Irish was warned for war on the 28th of December. So the battalion came back from leave in early January of 2003, expecting to see me gone and expecting to see our Gurkha company gone. And of course, when we paraded on the square, I'd been told to stay on in command. And the Gurkhas were still there, so they knew something was afoot. And I told them, within a month, we're going to the Middle East. And they thought I was kidding, but I certainly wasn't.
Doug Beattie's listening to this, former Royal Irish Regiment captain, now Ulster Unionist MLA. Doug, what Tim's sharing with us this morning, do you recognise that, the lack of preparedness, the... You know, having basically to improvise to have camouflage.
Yeah, absolutely, because I was Tim Collins, RSM, so I stood beside him when he made every decision that he made. So it absolutely resonates with me, even to the fact that on our battalion square at the time were green goddesses, because the battalion was still involved in Op Fresco, which was the National Firefighters Strike, and they wouldn't take that commitment away from us, even though we were preparing for war. So I do remember it. I remember it very well. And if I transport people back to the Kuwaiti desert and before we crossed into Iraq, the Royal Irish Regiment, which Tim commanded, and he was one of the best battalion commanders there at the time, we were an air manoeuvre battalion. We should be delivered to the battlefield by helicopters. We crossed the border into Iraq on the back of cargo trucks because there was no helicopters to be able to deliver us. Some people didn't have body armour. I remember the commanding officer not having body armour because he gave it to somebody else.
Some people didn't have body armour.
Yeah, we didn't have ammunition for certain weapon systems that we had for training. Soldiers didn't have desert boots. They were still wearing the black boots. And I remember a large box turning up. It's called a tri-wall turning up. And in that was all this disused clothing that had been dumped in there. And soldiers were rooting through it, trying to find a set of desert combats that would suit them for going across into war. So
that's extraordinary. Extraordinary.
And here's the thing. I'm going to quote Tim now, because Tim, I remember saying this, and he was absolutely right. Tim said, "We will go to war with what's in our pockets, and the rest will follow us up." And that's exactly what we did. We went to war with what was in our pockets, and we hoped the logistical chain would catch up with us. It never did. You know, by the time our contribution to the war fighting was done, we were still as badly equipped as we were when we started the conflict.
But, Colonel Collins, you were a commander in the Royal Irish Regiment, and I know you and I have maybe clashed slightly this morning about my question around Tony Blair, but is that the ultimately the fault? Because I find it will anger quite a few people to hear that you were being sent out, your men were and women were being sent out without proper body armour, without proper protection. But is that ultimately the responsibility of the Prime Minister? Or actually, where were the senior people within the army itself who must have been closer to knowing about that, who were allowing that to happen?
Well, look, the buck rests with the Prime Minister, but of course he has a Secretary for Defence, who's Jeff Hoon at the time, and he had been clearly told by the Defence Council we didn't have that. But, you know, again, the complexity of it, I can't get over you. The reality was that what we were being prepared to do, which Dougie describes, I can remember the Minimi machine guns arriving the night before we changed. We crossed the border, rather, and people complaining they didn't have instruction manuals. I said, well, give them to B Company. I mean, the reality was that we knew the job we had in hand to defeat the Iraqi army, we could do, and we did do, and we did it in 3 weeks. And so that was the first exam question. But we assumed wrongly, as it turned out, that the plan for the occupation, that was followed. There's been a plan for that. There was no plan for that. So right along the line, there was never a plan. There wasn't a plan.
But isn't it senior? Isn't it senior military officials that draw up a plan within the army?
But ultimately, in a democracy, the soldiers do what the democratically elected government does. That's our duty, and right or wrong, that's the will of the people, and that's what we do.
Could you explain some of the basics for me? So when I heard you in the Chilcot report yesterday, and you referred to it today, that some of the vehicles, they did not have the proper colour of camouflage, and in fact, farcically, you were painting it in hope and sand stuck to it for camouflage. That is incredible. Is there not a specific job within the army for someone to look after equipment? You know, I'm thinking of the stupid analogy of, in the BBC, there is someone whose job it is to make sure that the microphones work and the desks work. So
it goes back to the Defence Review in 1998, and the assumption in the Defence Review of 1998 was that the United Kingdom would be available for one major conflict at a time. Again, one of the decision points that was taken, erroneously in my view, was that we were already committed and heavily committed to operations in Afghanistan at the time. In fact, and as we speak, people from my company are mentoring the police special branch, and the head of special branch there says that he could mark the time when the rout of the Taliban, which was happening in 2002, 2003, ended, and they began their march back to Kabul. And that was the 20th of March, 2003, when we invaded Iraq. We took resources away from Afghanistan in order to support the Iraq operation. But the Defence Review had already said 4 years before, is we do not have the capability to do two major operations. The decision was taken at the top to do those two operations. As a result, Iraq, as we saw, became a failure. And I have to say, it critically and perhaps fundamentally damaged the operations in Afghanistan.
Doug Bailey, the big picture here is the country rushed to war. That's what critics of Blair would say. He should have known and did know that the equipment was not there, that we were not prepared, and he sent men and women in anyway.
Yes, and Tony Blair made a decision, and it turns out that decision was wrong. He was the Prime Minister, and therefore he is the man to blame. But that blame needs to be spread out. I mean, our intelligence chiefs need to take a fair degree of blame, MI5 or MI6. And our military chiefs need to take a fair degree of blame because they were not forceful enough to say we did not have the equipment to do that. But whenever we were crossing the border and whenever we were fighting that, you know, every single soldier really, honestly, 100% believed that this was a legal, just and noble cause. I remember us having to take chemicals, a cocktail of chemicals, nerve agent pre-treatments. We were all getting shots in our arm for anthrax. We thought we were going to face chemical weapons the moment we crossed that border, which was not the case. And the government knew that was not the case. There is blame, but you can blame all we want. The reality is what we have to do is inform our foreign policy for the future, and we need to put in place triggers and mechanisms to stop the armed forces being used in a conflict when it's either not ready or not just.
Well, that's the big question, Doug, isn't it? Will governments be trusted in the future by this generation who trusted government before, and look what we're hearing now?
Well, democracy is damaged. I mean, we heard from Jeffrey earlier on, and Jeffrey voted in favour of going to war, and he did so based on the information that was provided for him, as did many of the MPs, including MPs from the Ulster Unionist Party, for going to war. And that information was flawed. So it has damaged our democracy, and we need to get trust back into it. It has damaged our military and our military standing in the world, and we need to get that back on an even keel. So there's lots and lots of lessons to be learned from this. And the person who said this is 2.5 million words of hindsight is probably right, but that hindsight is incredibly important if we're not to make the same mistakes again in the future.
How many people did you lose, Tim, who you knew personally?
We didn't lose anyone in the battle group, but since that, a number of people have been lost. In Iraq, the Royal Irish went back under Colonel Michael McGovern, with people wounded there. People won very good gallantry decorations, and but also we think back to the Royal Irish efforts in Afghanistan and the casualties we took there in 2006 onward. But and those were a direct result of the denuding of resources in Iraq. These things have consequences, unintended consequences, I guarantee, but they have consequences. And so I think that the one thing I can tell you is that if you ever have to bury teenagers, it's the hardest thing. And the one thing that their parents want is their child back. And the one thing you can't give them is their child back. And the most you can do is say that they died for a good reason. And that's why we have to have these inquiries, as Doogie says, to make sure this never happens again. Nobody else loses their teenager.
Did those men die in vain, Doogie? Doug?
Well, you know, if on reflection for the families, you know, because of this report, it will feel like they did. But I've got to say that every one of those people deployed to Iraq to try and make the country a better place. It was a genuine belief of the military when we did so. So they did so trying to make it a better place. But I think Tim raises some really important things, is that, you know, if you don't resource a military properly when you send it to war, then there's going to be casualties. And many of those casualties were because we did not resource our military properly. So I don't like to say that they died in vain, because they died doing what they chose to do. They died doing what they believed was right. But I feel they were let down by our politicians.
I think Doogie's got that exactly right. I mean, there's a difference between dying in vain and dying needlessly. I think that removing Saddam Hussein, who's a hideous dictator, was a good thing. I know, because I was on the special forces, I'm not giving any state secrets away, or what we were messaging our information ops to the Iraqi military very clearly under their leadership was, you should get rid of Saddam Hussein, but if you don't, we'll get rid of him. But when we do, and when we come, we're going to rule the country with the Iraqi military and as partners. And yet when we went there, we disbanded the Iraqi military. So the actual intent was noble and just. The execution was appalling. And it's learning those reasons. And again, as I say, if people died because they were in a snatched Land Rover and only in it because someone didn't want to deploy heavier vehicles because it would look bad, well, that's a problem.
My goodness, I've learned something this morning. Colonel Tim Collins, thank you very, very much for coming on this morning. Doug Beattie, thank you.